is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
So when Ukrainian journalist Yulia Mendel got the call that she had been hired to work for President Volodymyr Zelensky, she had no idea what was about to come her way. Yulia Mendel has served as the press secretary and spokesperson for President Zelensky, president of Ukraine, from 2019 to 2021. She has a new memoir out, The Fight of Our Lives, My Time with Zelensky, Ukraine's Battle for Democracy, and What It Means for the World. It's out now. We get into a very interesting conversation around the style and leadership of President Zelensky and why it is so important to see and to witness globally in the face of Russian aggression. And how the two principles evolve, Zelensky and Putin, have played this chess match that represents 400 years of Ukrainian-Russian history. It is fascinating, and you don't want to miss it. It's coming up next, right here on the Michael Steele Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome again to the Michael Steele Podcast. I am really, really excited about our conversation today because, a lot of times Americans don't get an up-close understanding and appreciation for global events that impact us as much as they do anyone else in the world. We sometimes isolate ourselves from the conversation. So it was important, I think, particularly given not just the bravery, the tenacity, and the just incredible courage of the people of Ukraine under the leadership of Volodymyr Zelensky, to sort of get a feel for what that's about, but to have someone who has, as we like to say, been in the room, who can tell us firsthand. So it's with a great deal of pleasure we get to welcome Yulia Mendel to the podcast. So welcome, Yulia. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me and for actually raising the topic of Ukraine, which is very important these days.
Absolutely. And so let's just get right into the conversation. I love the way you set the tone for your memoir because, you know, a lot of times people approach these things from a sense of the difficulty of it, sort of a victimhood. You right out of the gate said, look, we are not victims when speaking of the Ukrainian people. Why was that important for you to note that from the start and sort of set the tone for what it was you wanted to say?
Wow, you start from so deep questions. Right, this is the book, The Fight of Our Lives. And in fact, what I consider and what my people consider in many ways that as soon as you recognize that you are a victim, you lose immediately. You mm-hmm. already lose. In this way, we are targets for Russians. That's definitely. And by the way, Ukrainians consider that we have been fighting Russian imperialism for 400 years. Just right now, it's a huge culmination. And, you know, it's the fight for modern values, democratic values, when the world already knows what is and how it is to be a free world, right? But in fact, even being targets to Russians, we are fighters. We are not victims. We did not bow to Putin. We did not accept any conditions to limit our freedoms. Actually, we didn't accept the conditions to to accept any kind of modern slavery that Russia wants to suggest to Ukraine. We are fighting for freedom, and we are proud to be the fighters.
It it's a stunning history in many respects, which again, a lot of Americans don't appreciate. You make the note that this isn't a new fight for the Ukrainians. It's been going on for quite some time with Russia, and it's a long term battle, if you will. So there's an appreciation, I think, an understanding of that resiliency, where it comes from. And I do appreciate the way you frame it, that, if you start from a position of victimhood, you're already losing, which I think really goes to the heart of the man himself, the once comedic actor who, amused and entertained the Ukrainian people on TV, now being one of the most profoundly important political and military leaders for the country. You note in the first chapter, quote, Zelensky changed Ukrainian politics forever. He disconnected a large portion of the Ukrainian political elite from their comfortable hold on power and attracted people from business, the arts, and television. He changed the narrative in the country, smoothing out the conflicts between warring ideologies. He presented Ukrainian identity as it really is, without pathos, but as a palette of many colors, not as a country to be pitied, but as a dynamic European democracy. I think a lot of people have seen that play out over the course of this current conflict. What has made Zelensky this great leader who sort of had the ability to tap into that spirit and to use the varied colors, as you put it, of life and culture and people in Ukraine to paint not just a mosaic of a modern day European country, but one that stands on the wall against autocracy and the hegemony of the Russian Empire?
Oh, well, Michael, I think that Volodymyr Zelensky is actually a great representative of the Ukrainian people, of the heart and soul of Ukrainians. And, he was often very underestimated for the reason that his image of a comedian was so popular, and politicians and Putin, they always were thinking, well, we need to deal with a comedian. But in fact, it was often ignored that he is a lawyer by education and that he built a huge business, which is Empire of Humor, in the post-Soviet country. And it was so difficult under pressure from Russia, because Russia was penetrating into information space and entertainment business of Ukraine. And it was enormously challenging for him. So in fact, being just a fun guy on the stage and showing his talents of an actor, as a leader, he is absolutely different. He has very serious approaches. He uses humor more, to connect the situations. But in many ways, I was wondering, I was surprised by myself when I started working for him. And we were going with him to Donbass. Just let me remind that Russia first invaded Ukraine back in 2014. And the military conflict with Russia had been for 8 years already when it started large-scale invasion. And we were traveling to Donbass because he wanted to show people that he was trying to achieve peace. We were going there every month, more than to any other country or region in Ukraine. And every time he was going to the front lines, sometimes to 10 what is called zero positions, like frontline positions per day, just to handshake with people. Even if there was shelling, Volodymyr Zelensky was fighting his personal security that did not allow him to go there, and still was going to the front line. He was saying, as a leader, I cannot leave them there under the threat. It means I'm coming then when it's calm, but then when it's shelling, I'm leaving. It's just not myself.
Right.
And so when he was offered to leave Kyiv, I knew he would not. So I was not surprised when he said, I don't need a taxi. I need ammunition, not a ride.
Right. Which was a moment that was appreciated around the globe. I mean, I just sort of elevated his stature in an amazing way when he was very clear about that.
Absolutely. And what you're absolutely right about the fact that we are watching the history. It's not the history of modern Ukraine only. It's the history of whole post-Soviet region and about geopolitical power shifts and about the transformations of many domestic politics in Europe and in the United States. It's about questioning ourselves how we allowed to lead to this, how we allowed ourselves to be dependent on a country that behaves as a terrorist, mm-hmm. how we allowed to maintain relations with such a country, how we allowed to actually make this invasion of democracy, because Ukrainians are fighting right now for the democratic values. We are fighting for our right to make a choice. We are fighting to live the life that we want to live and to share the values of the West. And we see the cracks in Russian system. Russia is the most aggressive and the most unpredictable autocracy around the world right now, and we see the cracks there inside. And this dictatorship, the dictator system, it seemed to be so stable and it seemed to be so strong, but with the failures of the army that was considered to be one of the biggest and the strongest in the world, we see that the system is also cracking, because people see that there are a lot of simulacres there, you know, just the propaganda in which they believed. But in fact, they turned corruption into the part of Russian identity, and they actually created a huge failed state. So we are fighting for the fact that this failed state cannot grab us, cannot, make more pain to us, and that we will stand with the free world for the values that we established after the World War II.
So you raise a number of, I think, important points, particularly when you consider the context of recent events, and specifically just recently, the election of Giorgia Meloni, the new prime minister of Italy, first woman to hold that position. But she is, a right-wing ideologue, as she's been described by many. Her party, the Brothers of Italy, is the old Mussolini party. They, have expressions, at least in the past, she's moderated some of that for the election, sort of the hard anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ language, et cetera, certainly cozied up to Putin earlier on in her career. So given someone like a Zelensky and now the emergence of someone like Meloni, and then, of course, even when you look at the recent battle in Paris between Macron and Le Pen almost winning that race. What should world leaders be learning from someone like Zelensky? And what, more importantly, should people be taking from that as they go to ballot boxes around the globe to elect the next generation of leaders? Are we looking at more Zelenskys or more Malonies?
You're right that many people are very concerned about powers that have extreme policies and that do not play for unification of the society and for acceptance of our differences. Let me say one very important lesson that I learned from Ukrainian politics. Being a neighbor to Russia, we have experienced for dozens of years of Russian penetration into Ukrainian politics. And how I'm describing in the book, The Fight of Our Lives, that many Russian political consultants were working for Ukrainian politicians, trying to divide the country based on our fears, our emotions, our differences. And this probably worked somehow for some of the politicians, but also it didn't work for the society, because you know, people were played off just to influence their political narratives and political decisions, political choices. And what Zelensky did and why he won such a record in Ukrainian society, because after such a long experience of being divided into, for instance, better patriots or worse patriots, like even better people or worse people. I'm not kidding. This is how Russia played off in our country. Mm-hmm. So after all these years, then Zelensky came to power and he actually offered a new ideology of unification. And he said that our differences make us stronger. And that worked so well for us that everybody believed that we need to follow this person. We need to look at us differently.
Right.
And that's how it made us so unified, self-organized, and disciplined when Russian invasion started back in February.
But it still presses the point, I think, for a lot of folks looking at this about that very thin line of danger between embracing fully full-throated democracy versus autocracy and totalitarianism, nationalism. And it does boil down to having more Zelenskys emerge globally to really kind of stem the at least the tide, as it seems to be right now, to embrace this sort of out of fear, some would say out of economic hardships, which you and I know, you know, the global recession, if you will, or certainly global slowdown that's occurring as a result of the Ukrainian war with Russia. There's a tendency for people to relax, and there's a tendency for people to try to escape to something better. And that's what a lot of these authoritarian leaders are offering.
Trying to explain, to offer simple solutions for the difficulties. Mm-hmm. And this does not work for the reason that, you know, the challenges that we are meeting, they're really like big and they're modern and they need new approaches. And we cannot just go to the past by trying to find the easy formula that used to exist. And this is actually what Putin is doing. You know, he tries to offer some simple idea and to play with people's fears. And that's why people try to find, you know, to find this situation when they are blind towards the things that they're doing, bad things that they're doing to the policies, politics, and other people in the society, but just looking for some kind of a comfort zone or stability. But the world is not stable, and being flexible is also what we can learn from Zelensky, because he is very dynamic, but he also is very flexible because he tries to follow the situation. And you're right that this is very scary that we see this rise of far right tendencies around the world, because then, you know, we can just destroy ourselves from inside. And this is, you know, when we are united, then it means that we respect each other and we are building democracy and we are respecting it. And democracy is always, it's not something that is given to anyone by the default. It's something that we need to cherish, something that we need to learn how to do. But then we are as united, strong organism with strong immunity, and we can stand against different viruses from outside. If we are just, you know, destroying ourselves, we are going to be weak in every matter, military, economy, and even in societal relations. If we want to be respected in the society, if we want to have the full rights, then, you know, we need to really face the challenges, but to respect differences and to understand that we need to be together, strong and united.
We're having a wonderfully insightful conversation with Yulia Mendel. She was the former press secretary and spokesperson for Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine from 2019 to 2021. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to get into What was some of the highs and lows of that job, Yulia? Because I'm sure there were in the years that you served as the voice for President Zelensky. We'll have more with Yulia right after this.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and I'm very, very pleased to welcome Yulia Mendel. She was the former press secretary and spokesperson for Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine. She has a wonderful new memoir out, The Fight of Our Lives, My Time with Zelensky, Ukraine's Battle for Democracy and What It Means for the World. It is out now. I think it's always important to get the insights of the person who was in the room. And Yulia, you were more than just in the room. You got to talk about what was in the room. What were some of the sort of challenges in the job that you had? But more importantly, I guess, also some of the fun stuff, because you mentioned earlier President Zelensky's sense of humor. He was a comedian and had that way of sort of bringing people together with humor. I'm sure that there, even in the more difficult moments, there were moments where you guys sort of looked at the situation and go, now, isn't this just crazy that we're here doing this because, you know, because of the actions of others or whatever it may be? So what was that like on the inside for you?
Oh, well, it's difficult to explain fast. It was definitely very exciting for the reason that imagine me, 32-year-old female, sitting at the table with much richer, more powerful men. Everybody of them wanted to influence president's decisions. Right. And many of them actually thought that my voice was not that strong as theirs, mm-hmm. was not that meaningful. But that's why, of course, it was exciting, but it was also tough. And let me say that it was even tough to get this position. People hardly believe that something like this can be true, but it was. So when Zelensky came to power, he was as popular as a rock star. And literally, like, almost everyone around wanted to work for him. And he became the first president to bring these business practices and to open the transparent competitions for some top political positions, as well as for his press secretary. In fact, he announced this position, this vacancy, just by going into Facebook and making a video there. But then there were HR companies, different stages, and here I am, top five, having an interview with the president. And there were around 4,000 applicants, and I won. I think there was one question that actually made Zelensky to hire me. He asked about my motivation for this job. And I said that if he, a person from a modest background, from some province, could be elected as the president of the country, and then me, a journalist from a poor background, in a transparent way, can become his press secretary, then together we can build a dream, Ukrainian dream, when everyone can achieve everything they want. And then, you know, I think Zelensky understood that we were sharing the same vision of the country. But then, yeah, you know, if you ask me about funny situation, there were a few. Zelensky is very hardworking. He drinks enormous cups of coffee, but he is also addicted to sports. And on the second day of my job, I learned that he was really serious about it and started every day with gym or jogging, you know, with some training. So we needed to make an interview, and that was a live broadcast to the biggest show in Ukraine. And they came actually to the gym, and he was training on the bicycle. And that was really, you know, funny for the reason that he made career playing a president who was riding a bicycle to work, avoiding luxury cars. And so he is just making an ordinary training, and then we are going out to the largest show and being asked the difficult questions about reforms, about politics, about geopolitics, about his trip, you know. So I mean, yeah, it was really strange, funny, but at the same time it changed the vision of the president, because in one moment he fell from like being, you know, just some big person into an ordinary one. Like a president could be an ordinary man. He who stayed, and that was really cool for the people of Ukraine. They loved it.
The every man, every woman feel from a politician is something that is regarded around the globe. It is very few people, very few politicians have that natural gift to make people feel comfortable, that in many respects, you're not just one of them in the trite sense, but you are familiar because you've spent time learning the language, if you will, of the everyday person, the everyday working man and woman, the everyday family man and woman. And that is something I think that even now, as I watch President Zelensky, and certainly when he addressed our Congress here in the U.S., even though it was via Skype, that sense came across, that determination, that hardworking attitude of getting the job done and getting it done right, really came across. And I suspect from your role as press secretary, trying to convey that yourself in your exposition of the efforts of the administration, and certainly when things started to turn when Russia invaded, and having to try to keep, you know, that connection alive, was a real challenge in the job, because you don't know when you get into these big military conflicts, Yulia, how the public is going to respond, right? You know, there are Russian influences inside of Ukraine, as we know, going back to 2015, et cetera. So you don't know how people are going to respond. So that had to have been a real interesting moment for you, given how you came into the job and the connection you made with Zelensky, to now be able to convey that publicly day in and day out as his press secretary, as his voice. What's been interesting?
Yeah, you're right that Ukraine used to have a huge influence from Russia, playing, you know, with people's emotions, with some nostalgia emotions, and having even the pro-Russian politicians in our parliament.
Right.
And of course, they, you know, try to play propaganda game on the internet, online, on TV, on radio, everywhere. But if you ask me the question about me seeing the president like this, I can say that definitely I expected that he would lead in crisis, because I saw a lot of such crises. But let me tell you one situation that really impressed me while working with him. We went to trip to Donbas, and I'm telling this story in my book, The Fight of Our Life. And there was a bridge that Zelensky renewed. This bridge was connecting the occupied territory of Ukraine under Russian control and the territory under the Ukrainian government. And he went there with another leader from another country who was visiting Ukraine. So we are approaching to the bridge, and suddenly we are all stopped. And the security says no one is making a step forward, because we see the guys, Russians and separatists on other side in occupied Ukraine with the guns standing near the bridge. And we see the Russian cameras there. And like, they could do anything, right? There were two leaders of the countries, and anyone could expect anything. President Zelensky was fighting his personal security for around 30 minutes. And then he, another leader, and few people from the security guard were approached the breach and left. He wanted to show to, like, the first initial plan was to show the breach to another leader as a symbol of connecting Ukraine, two parts of Ukraine. But what was more important was to show to another side that he was not afraid, that he was the leader of this land, that he was on his land, he belonged to it. And that's why, you know, he went there and he fought to be near those people who had rifles and cameras. And, you know, when I saw that, all other delegations just stayed on a distance and watched that. We hardly breathed because we didn't know what to expect. I understood that he is the person who can give up his personal security for belief in his country, for his people. And also I saw him meeting Putin. I don't know if you read this in the book,
mm-hmm.
but that was a big discussion because in Paris in 2019, he managed to talk to Putin about establishment of peace in Donbas. And I saw that Putin really lost that negotiations for the reason that Putin has developed this image of a strong man. But in fact, being a dictator, being in power for over 20 years, he hardly negotiated anything with anyone for this time. He was just ordering and expecting that people would maintain what he ordered. So he was really shocked by the fact how novice the landscape was prepared, how right. he understood the whole issues, and how he negotiated. So within this, I think that Zelensky is doing what is natural for him. And I don't know if he is really good in all the reforming, you know, and all this everyday politics. But as a person in chaos of war, he is a perfect leader for us. And that's why Ukrainians are so much appreciating him right now and are united around his image.
Well, let's pick up on the Putin section you talked about. Because in the book, you note, I'm often asked about my impressions of Putin. There is only one way to describe Putin: old age. What did you mean by that?
Oh, yeah, Michael. I didn't mean the age as itself.
Oh, I know you did. No, I know.
Yes.
I know.
Just for our listeners, what I meant, and I'm explaining this, I meant the old thinking, the outdated thinking, outdated worldview, outdated performance, behavior, mimics, wording, everything. They were like people from the past. And what they're doing right now in Ukraine, they are returning the horrors from the past. The horrors from World War II, genocidal practices, artificial famine, everything that the humanity had already passed and wanted to forget, you know, as a horrible movie or horrible dream, just keeping in memory that never again we should repeat it. And now we are seeing that it is being actually repeated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I thought, you know, they never can win for the reason that they are from the past. And we want to approach to move to the future.
You do, I think, an incredibly expert job of detailing, if you will, the two men and how Putin and Zelensky operated in this space, noting that, you know, for Putin, he didn't expect to find a leader who had been president of the country, who was a former comedian, been in the job for a few months, that he would be so well informed to be able to sit directly opposite him and know more than probably Putin in some regards with respect to the matters in front of them. How Zelensky was more pragmatic and it kind of put Putin a little bit on notice for sure, but probably a little bit on edge. How would you assess, if you will, the two men? How do you see Putin and Zelensky as global players in this very dangerous game?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, they were like from different dimensions and from different epochs, from different eras. Putin at first was very self-confident. He behaved as he was already a winner, a leader, you know, because he did not need to prove anything to anyone. He has been in power for years and years and years. And Zelensky was a novice. So everybody, you know, expected him to maybe fail a little bit or make mistakes.
Right.
But so he tried really hard. I know that Zelensky was like learning really a lot, like studying all the information, trying to see what will be more beneficial for the country. And so when they talked and everything started changing for the reason that Putin understood that he could not move forward. First, he was playing his own propaganda. But Zelensky was very polite, very diplomatic, and he kept repeating his position until he heard the feedback, positive feedback. For instance, you know, when he heard propaganda back as an answer, like Russia was trying to say, we're not the part of this war, like we're not participating in this war, we have not attacked. Zelensky did not agree or disagree, but he was saying, yes, but what I mean, maybe you didn't understand me. Let me explain once more. And he was pushing and pushing in this diplomatic way. And Putin started feeling very uncomfortable. He started putting his eyes down. He was asking all the time his advisors for any piece of advice, for the information, saying that they will need to learn the information. He didn't feel comfortable even sitting in the chair. And it showed how with such a mild approach, diplomatic approach, Zelensky managed to win the negotiations. And that's exactly why Putin did not agree for any other round of negotiations, for any meeting, and even stopped talking to Zelensky. I think in summer 2020, he disagreed to have even a telephone conversation with Zelensky because he knew that every time Zelensky could push to his own decisions with mild, diplomatic, and polite approach.
It really says a lot, doesn't it, about how these two men sort of came into each other's orbit, and one thinking that he had the upper hand and the other recognizing the moment at hand and rising to it in a way that drew the world to his corner, which leads to, I think, some of the frustration that I want to get into, because you do spell that out rather expertly. You talk about how the president Zelensky approached the West, NATO, and the U.S. and the allies of Ukraine, his frustration with the process of getting the resources and the help that Ukraine needed. You note a quote from the book, Zelensky could not accept the West's reluctance to provide enough assistance to assure military victory. He understood the need to use overwhelming force with Putin's army. In nearly every speech, he implored NATO to do more, and each time the Western allies demurred, afraid to provoke Putin. This Western logic struck you as me, meaning you, as curious. Putin had so little respect for the Western world order that it did not matter to him whether a country belonged to the EU or NATO. Poland knew it. The Baltic states knew it. His insane and seemingly insatiable imperialistic ambitions had no limits, and no treaties would protect any country at his doorstep. You go on. Ukraine had been warning the West about this for years, but the West did not believe it. As the war intensified, Zelensky became angrier and angrier about the West's inaction. Tell us about that period, which to some extent still persists, a little bit less so in recent months as the U.S. Has significantly stepped up its financial and military support. But certainly in the beginning, at least for a lot of us here, Yulia, that was a real frustration for Americans too, that it seemed like, mm-hmm. okay, you guys are saying this is important. You're saying Ukraine is is a sister nation with us. You know, here's our brother, President Zelensky, in the fight. Give the man what he needs.
Michael, what was that like for
Zelensky and the team to run into this seemingly difficult wall to get support from the West?
Michael, you're right that there is the dynamics of these, you know, approaches and relations. And right now, the latest polling that was out yesterday showed that 80% of Ukrainians consider that the recent successes and that the successes in this war, that Ukraine is an independent country and we are giving the fight back, is happening thanks to Ukrainians and the Western partners. Mm-hmm. And Ukrainians usually consider Americans being the example of freedom. That's how actually, you know, I've seen Americans for all my life. For us, it's really example of freedom. So we believe that we share this value. At the very beginning, it was different. It was difficult. And I put those quotes and I put those words there because I believe that they did not show Zelensky's opinion. They showed what every Ukrainian was feeling. You could just put us in our yourself in our place and understand that our world around was collapsing. And I know now that, and I knew that Ukrainian government was working on different scenarios before the war, like really different ones. But nobody expected that the horrors from the past would come in such a large scale, that Russians would come so easily to Kyiv. But let me say that the underestimation of this military invasion was happening around the world. The West believed that Ukraine would collapse in several days or several hours. Putin believed that he would take over Ukraine and put his puppet regime and kill Zelensky, right, and just own the country in a few days. The thing is that everybody was wrong about this war. But even if we had all those amount of intelligence, I have a question. Nobody agreed to sanction Russia before when Russia was preparing its weapons. We were not given any weapons. And we were advised to make trenches, to dig trenches. And everybody knew that Russia was just killing us from the sky. And that was so painful for the reason that, you know, I'm bursting in cry even every day right now, understanding that so many people died, were killed mm-hmm. so brutally and survived right. through such horrible things. And that meant for us, we begged for the weaponry. We begged because that could help. So many people, they felt that they were left behind, like left for ourselves. But it started changing. And I believe that Zelensky was one of the biggest powers who contributed to the unification of the whole civilized world. And every soldier who stands in the front lines of Ukrainians showed that he or she is eager to sacrifice life for what is considered freedom. And that's how I saw that Americans had this very personal approach, personal understanding of this tragedy. And the government of the United States and the government of other countries started changing approaches very fast. So right now we're in the position when we understand that we could sacrifice our lives. But without all the necessary reforms, there would not be these successes. And I hardly believe Ukraine would be an independent country these days. And we need to we need to continue this approach. We need to be united until Russia does not stop these killings and does not leave Ukraine. We need to be together. Because if we just stop right now, then we can retrain, just forget all the achievements, because Russia will attack again. We are sure about that.
Yeah, I think that's the clear thing. I mean, you have, at least in Putin, an ideologue who has this worldview of Russia. And it's not even about returning to the old Soviet Union. It is returning to an imperial Russia, which in my mind is as dangerous as the old Cold War Soviet Union, because it runs a little bit deeper. It's much more deeply rooted in history. And so the moment right now for our allies, the allies of Ukraine, to stand with not just Zelensky, but most especially with the Ukrainian people, I think is an important one. not just because of the principle, but also and especially because of the history, as you noted throughout the book, that the linkage between the past and the present is a real thing. and there's a real history that exists between these two countries over 400 years.
Right.
And to have someone like President Zelensky at this hour, I think it's historic on a number of levels.
You're absolutely right. You know, especially this over 70 years of Soviet Union, when modern people, they had relatives both in Russia and Ukraine. They were building families where there could be like Russian husband and Ukrainian wife, or vice versa, kids, you know, cousins, etc. And then suddenly it changed. And I see from my friends, I don't have relatives in Russia, but I see how many families fell apart. They simply do not find any single language anymore, for the reason that many Russians, they believe in propaganda or justify themselves, you know, just to avoid responsibility. And Ukrainians, you know, we're not going to lie ourselves. We are being invaded, we are being killed, and everything that happens is no less than war crimes and genocide for us.
Right.
So all these ties, they're being ruined, as well as Russia has ruined so-called Russian world, Ruskiy Mir. Russia tried to artificially create this kind of ideology and insisted on its existence on post-Soviet space. And we simply disagree, because Ukraine just has its own identity, and we don't understand why we need to be under Russian imperialistic politics, and why do we need to live as Russia does. For the reason that, you see, even if any Ukrainians had some kind of nostalgia to Soviet Union, and even if there was strong propaganda, and even if they had some connections to Russia, it's very hard right now to believe in any kind of Russia's lies, for the reason when this Russian army came to so-called liberate us, as they say, from ourselves, and started stealing our toilets and washing machines,
mm-hmm.
people said, no, it just doesn't work like that. Like, we understand how much we achieved, and we are going to move the way we chose. But also the other thing is, I have a very close person to me. She's under occupation right now, and she said to me, it's impossible to see that the army with which we were fighting Nazi back in the Second World War turned into fascists themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was such a strong phrase that showed that there cannot be a connection between Russia and Ukraine now. And I don't know how much time it can take to renew these relations. But in fact, the most appropriate way for renewal of these relations would be Russian responsibility and accountability. We don't see that Russia has any kind of thinking about this.
The book is The Fight of Our Lives, My Time with Zelensky, Ukraine's Battle for Democracy and What It Means for the World. Yulia Mendel, you bring an important memoir and narrative to a story that a lot of us don't really get to see up close the way you've presented it, and appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast to share some insights, personal insights, for, you know, being one of 4,000 to land in the job of an incredible lifetime as the press secretary and spokesperson for the once and future president of once comedic and now future president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. Real pleasure having you on.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing my word with your audience, and thank you for telling the story of Ukraine.
Oh, absolutely. We stand in solidarity and really appreciate the inspired leadership of your president, and especially your people. We, you know, Americans to some degree over the years have gotten a little bit comfortable with the sloganeering around, you know, patriotism and faith and things like that. And But you're seeing it lived out every day on the battlefield, in the neighborhoods, in the communities of Ukraine, as grandmas take up arms to defend democracy and to defend their way of life and their history. And that's a very proud thing to see. So
freedom must prevail.
Amen. Amen. And again, we thank you so much for coming on. That does it for our conversation today, folks. Really appreciate it when you take the time to spend with us. I want to thank Yulia for joining us. Follow her on Twitter if you want to stay in touch with what's going on in her work and certainly in Ukraine. She's on Twitter at Yulia Mendel. That's I-U-L-I-I-A Mendel, M-E-N-D-E-L. And don't forget to check me out on Twitter as well at Michael Steele. We love it when you do the podcast thing. Download us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And until next time, be safe, be well, take care. And elections are coming up, and you know what you got to do. Vote, right? Got to vote. So until then, be good.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here, and you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.